Hello and Happy New Year. This is WOC correspondent Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm going to play you through a retrospective of what I consider to be my best interview segments from 2018. My work for WOC tends to focus on topics related to the media. So in what follows, you'll be hearing conversations about local newspapers, video game companies, and the overall state of Tech Valley in New York. To start out, here's my interview with Beck Krefting on the course that she teaches on post-apocalyptic film and literature at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. The first half of this interview aired on WOC not long ago, but since I have some extra time to work with today, I decided to play the full interview rather than only playing the second half. Here it is. I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Beck Krefting about the course that she teaches on post-apocalyptic film and literature at Skidmore College. Rebecca Krefting, who goes by Beck, is the chair of the American Studies Department at Skidmore. She studies and writes about humor and laughter, social identities, visual and popular culture, identity and difference, women's history, theater and performance, and doomsday preppers and post-apocalyptic cultural texts. Beck, thanks for coming on the program today. It's good to be talking with you.
It's absolutely great to be here, Aaron. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So to start out, I want to ask for your take on why apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narratives are so pervasive in the major forms of storytelling media today. From film to TV to graphic novels and video games, you see it everywhere. What factors of our era encourage the prevalence of these genres?
So post-apocalyptic and apocalyptic stories have historically always dealt with a kind of transcoding of cultural anxieties and fears, attitudes and opinions, but it's the cultural anxieties and fears that really resonate with people when they're consuming these texts. And I'm using transcoding from Douglas Kellner. He talks about this as a way to basically decode the various fears, anxieties that we share and that are commonplace enough that we can actually visibly and noticeably see them when they're in these post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic texts. They also, and I have my students actually contend with precisely this question, so I was really delighted to see it because I have them engage with a symptomatic analysis, and this is a method of reading text such that you are trying to ferret out what actually caused an interest in this in the first place. So it requires a number of things. You have to think about the various forces that would have shaped the production of that text. So maybe it was a natural disaster. Maybe they're relying on shared cultural fears around shootings, right, in schools, or 9/11 was a huge critical kind of turning point in our society wherein the United States felt vulnerable. It was an impact on our own soil. So these are things I'm asking students to grapple with that require them to both think about these fomenting events as well as the creation process, the production process. So looking at interviews from the people who created the text to see what actually influenced the creation of that. So you might have an author say, you know, I am influenced by my family having been in the Holocaust, even though they're writing in the 21st century, but that still has a kind of thread in there that you can see. Whether or not society picks up on that, that's another thing. But in the transcoding process, one way to establish that is to also think about reception. And so you can actually go in and look at reception and see what people are responding to favorably or not. And that tells its own story of what we're preoccupied with and what we focus on. I'll say too that there's been shifts in how we consume and receive these post-apocalyptic texts. And one of the things I ask my students to think about are how we build those stories and then what kind of messages those stories send. So for instance, after 9/11, some research has been done on the way apocalyptic stories in particular are being told, and the focus after 9/11 in these texts tell a different kind of story than they did before 9/11. And that story is one wherein we are to blame for our actions and perhaps we shouldn't be saved after all, whereas the texts that came before usually were predicated on some kind of lapse in our technology, but we could resolve that issue. We found ways of actually ameliorating whatever that issue was. In post 9/11, it wasn't necessarily something we could solve, and there was and is a kind of through line that we deserve what we got because we weren't paying attention to things in the first place.
And do you think perhaps that a sense of collective guilt about some of the nefarious aspects of U.S. foreign policy that might have contributed to the 9/11 attacks could also be factoring in to that transcoding process?
I do. I absolutely think that all of those things factor in, but I think you cannot talk about any single thing or even a combination of things without considering our convergence culture that we're in today, the way media is able to hit us in so many different ways. So there's always been fear around various kinds of engagements on the global stage. And so what I think distinguishes earlier kind of moments wherein fear might have been developed, say, during the Cold War. But now we have all of this media that continues to inundate us with these fear-based messages. And so with the actual things that are happening, combined with the amount of media sensationalized and fear-based as it is, I think it plays to our fear and then tends to exacerbate it.
So for the more detail-oriented members of our listening audience, can you explain the distinction between apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic stories? What's the difference between these two genres?
So I love this question because people get it wrong all the time. And it's an important distinction and one that I have my students also wrestle with. And that is in a post-apocalyptic text, or let's start with it and thinking of it in terms of kind of a line, a linear line. And I'm going to do even more than talk about apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic. I'm going to draw a through line to dystopic as well. So if you think about it as a kind of continuum, a line, on one end, you're going to have apocalyptic stories. And these are texts that signal an end to society as we know it. And it's because of an apocalyptic sized event, right? So it could be a natural disaster, it could be aliens, it could be solar flares, what have you. Regardless, the focus is on the dissolution of society and the social contract that we have in place. Therein, it has various messages that are being conveyed to the viewing public, right? So these are things that are happening right now. And because we didn't deal with them, like climate change, we now have to deal with this apocalypse. So the focus is on the breakdown of society as we know it. And that's the story through and through. It might end and have a little bit of time where they focus on the aftermath, but really it's around the destruction of the social contract. And so a post-apocalyptic text distinguishes itself from apocalyptic text by focusing on that aftermath. So it usually rushes through the apocalypse, gives us a little bit of information. Some texts like The Road give you barely any at all, and you have to surmise based on the various examples and extrapolation on the environment to understand what has happened. And then others make it very clear what happened. So post-apocalyptic texts start at the point in which we are now in a state of nature. So the social contract no longer exists. There's no law enforcement, there's no government, there's no political authority or officials telling you how to do anything. Therein lies the liberatory potential of post-apocalyptic stories. And one of the things I talk to my students about is that if this is about starting over, how amazing is it that we get to imagine the possibilities for what starting over looks like? So it deals with social issues in a completely different way than an apocalyptic text. An apocalyptic text can say, this is where we went wrong, and these are the consequences of those actions. And a post-apocalyptic text says, this is where we went wrong, but this is how we can do it better. And to imagine otherwise puts a lot of power in the hands of these creators. Also bears the distinction of providing us as a consuming audience with imagining different ways of governing ourselves and interacting with each other. The dystopic story, on the other hand, is predicated on the resurrection of that social contract. So now we have a new social contract. We have those mechanisms in play that are synonymous: political and social institutions, law, enforcement of that law, etc. And this focus, though, tends to be a pretty negative focus on issues that we see as relevant today, having played out over time. So now we're in the future and we see like The Handmaid's Tale, right? So what happens when women don't have reproductive rights? And that becomes the next logical conclusion for Margaret Atwood. She imagines forward and says, if you wrest those rights from women, then this is the kind of society ultimately we might be headed towards. And therein lies also its own set of messages and possibilities. But I make my students understand the post-apocalyptic aspect of it. And that's where we spend most of our time.
So to connect it to some well-known examples, the Hunger Games would be dystopic because it's after an apocalypse that leads to the rise of a dystopian society. The Mad Max series would initially be apocalyptic because it's everything falling apart, but then there's a social order that emerges in the later films. And something like 28 Days Later, where it's just chaos and marauders, would be apocalyptic.
Absolutely. That's actually perfect. Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about your course on post-apocalyptic fiction? What sort of media narratives do you examine in it? And how do your students respond to them, particularly in terms of their own lives and their sense of the future?
Sure. So the course is framed around a variety of different possibilities for a society-ending event. So we have plagues and viruses at the outset of the course. The second part of the course focuses on economic ruin and nuclear fallout. And then a later portion in the class focuses on zombies and vampires, because that has been such a pervasive text, even though we know that it's not actually likely, if at all possible. I still want to give attention to that because it consumes so much of our visual landscape right now. The course, I focus on delivering methods to understanding and analyzing popular culture. So it really is a methods course in disguise. So I veil it, thinly disguised veil of post-apocalyptic, but it's really about forcing them to think about reception analyses or production analyses. They have to conduct a symptomatic analysis, which is what I was talking about earlier, around, you know, why this text, why now? And understanding and being able to make arguments to that effect. They have to understand how to do a close reading of a text, a semiotic and discursive analysis. They also have to conduct a formal analysis, as well as genre analysis. So one of the first things we do is chart the conventions of the genre so that we have a shared understanding and language around these various conventions. And so every subsequent text, then we examine that for the various conventions that it upholds and that it breaks. And the students, by the end of the semester, have such a keen sense of those conventions and the way that they play out in various texts that they then play with them as they produce their own post-apocalyptic text.
So as they become more familiar with the formal conventions of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic storytelling, does it make it more difficult for them to relate the issues in the text to their own lives insofar as they start to seem sort of cliched or aestheticized and perhaps not so relevant to reality as it unfolds in a non-narrative, more random way, in the sense that the apocalypse, if it actually happened, wouldn't necessarily have the quality or the structure of a narrative to it. It wouldn't really fit within a genre format. So does it make it harder for them to relate it to their own lives and to the potentially apocalyptic threats hanging over our own civilization when it's put in a kind of formal box in that way?
I see. So the question is, because it's set in a post-apocalyptic genre, does it have less impact on them in terms of how they're understanding it and relating it to their own life as opposed to maybe an apocalyptic text?
Well, particularly as citizens or occupants of a civilization that is facing at least potentially apocalyptic threats, does the difference between apocalypse as fiction, apocalypse as narrative, apocalypse as something that's aesthetically constructed, and the apocalypse as something that's a real threat that's potentially hanging over society as we know it, does that introduce a sort of dissonance in terms of their own ability to relate to it?
Yes, so I actually thought that it would, and I have been proven incorrect throughout the three iterations that I have thus far taught for this course. I really thought that they would be able to identify aspects of their culture and society that were problematic. This is inherent in post-apocalyptic texts. They're intended to function in that way. What I have found, though, is that the students relate to it insofar that they see that building, that starting over, as a kind of social justice enterprise, and they really connect with that. So they're here, you know, at liberal arts college at Skidmore, and they are absolutely steeped in how to become a better citizen, how to serve not only their local constituents, but a kind of global community too. How do you be a better person in this world? And so for the post-apocalyptic text, they connect by saying, oh, I can generate, produce things that actually demonstrate a new socially just world wherein they feel like they're making real contributions. However, there is that concern, right, that they're not thinking very concretely about some of the more pressing concerns.
That's interesting, because it sounds like what you're saying is that the progressive or even potentially utopian implications of the apocalypse are something that they're able to relate to their own lives in terms of their vision for the future and the ways that they want to transform society. And if you think about that in terms of another type of narrative, namely utopian narratives, those often have that kind of structure to them. The Communist Manifesto in particular is a story. It's almost like a narrative of a arrival of a secular New Jerusalem. And that itself involves a certain level of apocalyptic conflict that's leading to the emergence of the new society. And perhaps there's something in that that's making it possible for your students to think about this in a positive way.
Absolutely. And I think, too, it signals something that might be a little concerning, which is there seems to be more reticence around fixing the ills at hand than imagining what the future could be if we undid all of this. And that's not a really practical solution. It's not a way forward. It's an interesting observation, and it's, I think, valuable to consider and contemplate how that shows up in our text. But if I want my students to get engaged in contemporary issues that I see as particularly problematic and perhaps exacerbating our movement towards a society-ending event, I don't know if post-apocalyptic fiction gets us there, or if I'm doing it the right way in order for us to get there.
Well, I wouldn't blame yourself. The very fact that they're narrativized in particular ways by our culture means that those narrative acts need to be studied and broken down for what they are. But another question that's very closely related to what we were just talking about is, why do stories of the apocalypse so often tend to involve supernatural elements like zombies and vampires, or sci-fi elements like machines taking over the world? It strikes me that this might be a bit of a double-edged sword. At one level, the motifs allow for fictionalized reflections on contemporary anxieties about consumerism and technology, like zombies wandering around in shopping malls and whatnot, but they may distract from more pressing and genuinely apocalyptic threats like global warming and the continued existence of nuclear weapons. So at the cultural level, why do you think that audiences are so drawn to fantastical renderings of the apocalypse? Is it an attempt to sublimate it or keep the effect from being too alarming? Is there a way that we're defending ourselves by putting this sci-fi spin on it?
Aaron, I'm no psychologist, but I think you're definitely tapping into something there. We have a desire to see fantastical renderings of anything because it's pleasurable to consume, and it gives us distance, right? It gives us distance between our reality and that thing in the future or what could be. I think about texts like, if you compare The Road versus Aliens as a film, The Road, I think, actually works much better as a book. As a film, it just really kind of plods along. You have to be invested in it. And I think the only reason why they made the film is that the book was so popular and had such a vociferous following that they thought, of course, this movie is going to make money. But Aliens draws you in a completely different way. It's exciting. It's action-packed. The possibilities that the entire world is going to end is there as a possibility, not as inevitability, whereas in The Road, it is, and it's written into The Road. There's actually no state of nature in The Road, and that's partly why it's such a bleak and desolate landscape for the two protagonists. So let me back up and say that part of the reason why we're so fascinated with post-apocalyptic texts that they stand at the crossroads of two particular kinds of genres that have proven very popular, and that is the horror and the sci-fi genre. So bear with me for a moment. So in a horror film, you have the various characteristics or the emotions evoked by horror are usually fear, right? Terror, and it's localized. It's that guy trying to get you and maybe a small posse of people that are with you. And because of that, it's fear-based, and it has a linkage to a kind of moral chaos, usually internal, psychological, and we're fighting supernatural elements. The sci-fi text, on the other hand, invokes things like wonder and interest as opposed to terror. It plays with things like social chaos rather than moral chaos. And then it also focuses on society's reaction to catastrophe rather than a more localized person's reaction to a predator. So the great part about these texts, post-apocalyptic texts or apocalyptic, those can also sit at the crossroads there, is that they can actually encapsulate all of those things. So they evoke that wonder and interest, but also terror. They're getting us to think about how we respond to society in a catastrophic condition, but they're also thinking about how individuals respond. And therein lies some of the interest too, because people like to consume post-apocalyptic texts to imagine what they would do in the same situation. There's also zombie and vampire texts, for instance, really invoke that kind of terror that is both localized and global all at the same time, because it's that single zombie that can eat you and turn you into another zombie, but it's also the horde and the implications of that. So part of why it's so popular, I think, is that it's already pulling from two popular kinds of modes of storytelling. And then on top of it, it's playing to consumers' desire to take in and ingest things that are fantastical alongside a world that's wholly imaginable. So therein lies the success too. So if you take it out, it just becomes a romp on the moon where zombies have suddenly taken over. I think we might find that interesting, but maybe not as pleasurable as a world wholly imaginable, which is why most of these kinds of texts are set in a region, area, country that we can identify.
That relates to one more question I want to ask you. The Hudson Mohawk magazine is a local news show. So are there ways in which the motif of the apocalypse as it plays out at the level of mass culture and things like The Walking Dead can also get us to think about local social conditions and the bonds that hold people together in a more localized framework in ways that might be useful if we actually undergo some sort of event that for material reasons results in the relocalization of society, like for instance, a peak oil scenario or a disruption of global supply chains that forces people to rely on each other and get to know each other and work together more effectively and more holistically than they do now?
That's a fantastic question / observation that I think is quite accurate. I think there are two things that help to jumpstart our reflexivity around how to make our community stronger and how to get away from some of the social ills or problems that beleaguer any community. So those two things are thinking about these stories, these events that happen at a large scale, like a 9/11, that really rock us to our core, remind us of our humanity because we see other people who have reached out and are helping other people at to their own cost or detriment, their own lives perhaps. There's also those local incidents where things happen, a Sandy Hook, for instance, where you see a community rally around a particularly awful event, but what comes out of it is a sense of community and value in that. And then you see, I don't know that anyone's done these studies, but I would imagine that you would see a kind of ripple effect from that. I don't know how long that would last, but it certainly does force people to recognize their vulnerability and then to realize that interdependence is actually a really important thing. One maybe related thing here is that in St. Louis, and now there's chapters everywhere, but it started in St. Louis, there's a group called the Zombie Squad. And the Zombie Squad goes around and offers emergency response after some kind of natural disaster or major event. And they're trained to do that, and they work with their local first responders in order to do that. And this organization does that because they actually are all preppers. And so part of this comes out of a desire to be prepared in the event of these kinds of catastrophes, but also to make sure their entire community is prepared. So to me, they stand out as a model of how we can build a kind of infrastructure outside of government or medical responses so that we then can see the value of community response and learn from that and understand community response.
So that sounds like at least one way in which the more fantastical renderings and some form of genuine material preparation for the possibility of an apocalyptic event have come together, because they call themselves the zombie squad,
yeah.
Right? So perhaps there is more of an interplay between the pop culture rendering of these events and the material possibilities for which we have to be preparing as a society than initially seems to be the case.
Absolutely. Popular culture informs our actions and our behaviors. And in this case, when it comes to the zombie squad, they've put it to good use. But then it can conversely have a pretty negative impact. Like, for instance, I also study comedy. And so I've noticed an influx in stand-up comics who reference things like going out and buying a gun or weapons or taking some kind of self-defense course in order to defend themselves. There's nothing wrong with the latter. But I'm saying if you're out there arming yourself because you just saw Dawn of the Dead, I'm a little concerned about that particular kind of reaction. Right. But you're right. We are incorporating these messages in really critical ways, and they're playing out in interesting, provocative, and unsettling ways.
Well, thanks very much for this interview, Beck. It was great talking with you, and I'd like to have you back on the show again at some point in the future.
I would be delighted to return, Aaron. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. So that was me and Beck Krefting talking about post-apocalyptic media. Up next is part one of my interview with Rex Smith, editor and vice president of Albany's Times Union newspaper. This segment originally aired in June of 2018. I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Rex Smith, the editor and vice president of Albany's Times Union newspaper, about the challenges of producing locally and regionally based news in the age of Trump. Rex, thanks very much for sitting down for this interview. It's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So to start out, I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of how the Times Union negotiates a challenge that's often faced by newspapers located in the capital city of an American state, which is that its target readership is made up of a somewhat mixed demographic. At one level, you're expected to serve as a news source for the city of Albany, but Albany is the central city of the Capital District in the Capital Region, so you're also expected to cover news in Schenectady, Rensselaer, and Saratoga counties. But given that Albany is also the state capital, you're expected to cover state politics and other important stories and news at a statewide level. Then, at the level of the national media, there's a certain expectation that the Times Union serve as both a go-to source of New York State politics news and a kind of unofficial voice of Albany. So my question is, how does the Times Union juggle the pressures of this complicated situation?
You know, every newspaper has to juggle the reality of the fact that we don't have enough resources to do everything that we need to do. That is especially more challenging now in the digital age as newsrooms have shrunk. And we can talk about that a bit. With respect to the capital region specifically, you're right that we have an unusual challenge, let's say. Because not only do we have the responsibility to be the watchdog on state government, which we take very seriously, we have the largest bureau in the state capital of any news outlet in the state, but we also have an unusual community in that we don't have a center city with suburbs surrounding us the way many communities do. The capital region really is a suburban community. We are a cluster of small cities with suburbs in filling. So actually, we have more readers in the town of Colony than we do in the city of Albany. Our largest school district is Shenandoah. It's not Albany City. So we really need to be respectful of the fact that people are looking for a little bit of everything from the Times Union. That said, we can't be all things to all people. We have to be choosy in deciding that we're going to cover things that we think have the greatest potential for making a difference in people's lives and fulfilling our responsibility in democratic society to be that watchdog. So we do give more attention to state government and politics than another news organization might in a community of this size, because nobody else is going to do it if we don't. We also think that that kind of watchdog reporting makes good business sense. It is what sets us apart. Every business needs to have something that makes it unique in the marketplace, that gives it a niche. For us, it is that watchdog reporting on state and local government, which the TV stations here don't do. The other newspapers are too small to do. The out-of-town media that are serving the capital region don't really look at it the way we do, because they are resource-constrained at the state capital. So the result is we have a heavier diet of state government watchdog reporting and political reporting than many of our suburban readers might want, but we think we are serving those state readers who really care about it. That is particularly shown by the fact that our digital presence is enormous on days when the state workforce is here. Monday is our biggest day digitally. It's our smallest day in print. But on Monday, when the state workers show up at their office, our digital presence just spikes. TimesUnion.com goes crazy. It is our biggest day. So we know that we are being read by state workers at their desks often, and that means that we need to deliver to them especially this content on state government and politics. For our local readers, we try to give them stuff that is important as well as interesting. And sometimes that means just a sweet story about some athlete at a high school here who has achieved a lot, or a fun story about what's happened to somebody who was once prominent and is now driving an Uber or something. So we find that we are constantly adjusting what we're doing, but we are cognizant of the fact that this state government coverage is something that is a special responsibility for us.
Okay, so that touches on a number of complicated challenges that come to bear on your job as editor of the Times Union. Now I want to turn to a factor that's likely making it even more challenging for you, namely the extent to which the Trump administration has been drawing the attention of news consumers away from issues of local, regional, and even state-level importance and towards the daily antics of the president. Based on what you know about your own readership, what sort of effect is this having on people's interest in news stories that are closer to home, and how is the Times Union responding to that situation?
Well, our niche as the provider of unique content on local and state issues means that our front page rarely has national news, even in the era of Trump, when he seems to suck all the oxygen out of the room for every other kind of content nationally. We figure that people get a full helping of Trump news by watching cable television, by looking at national media. Especially in the digital era, there's no reason why people have to turn to the Times Union for that. So we give them some of that inside our newspaper, not on the front page, because there's no reason for us to replicate what they can get in greater depth with reporting from those other sources. We instead make our front page filled with state and local news. Our opinion pages, however, reflect the broad range of content, and we think people appreciate that. We're about a third and a third and a third national, state, and local in the content on our opinion pages. But I do think that the impact of the Trump era on local news is twofold, at least. First, people's attention, yes, is diverted from what's going on locally, and their attention, as even reflected in their conversations with each other in the supermarkets or at parties and the like, is about Trump. So yes, people's attention is diverted from what's local to what's national. And second, his constant attacks on the media. In the aftermath of his meeting in Singapore, he said that the greatest enemy of America is the news media. What an outrageous thing for a president to say. What an outrageous, unpatriotic thing for a president to say. And so that really undermines our credibility, I'm afraid, even with our local citizens, our readers, even on matters of local news. And I think that is going to end up being a terrible effect at the end of the Trump presidency, that he will have had the effect of significantly diminishing the capability of the American media to serve its traditional role of watchdog.
So as the editor of a paper that focuses considerable attention on state, regional, and local news, can you comment specifically on the impact that Trump is having on how much people are following news related to the state assembly and the Cuomo administration? Are there any big stories in state politics that aren't getting quite the public attention they deserve due to the focus on Trump?
I think that's true, not so much because the Trump coverage diverts our limited news hole as much as the impact on people's attention span and their own interest. Folks have become accustomed to the notion that you can't trust what a politician says. If everything coming out of the White House is hyperbole, as is the case, you know, he's back and forth on this and that. Kim Jong-un goes from being a little rocket man one day to being highly respected 6 months later. And so there is little expectation, diminishing expectation, I should say, on the part of our readers that what they are hearing from government is credible and worth paying attention to. Because what you hear today may not be what you hear tomorrow. Because everybody believes that facts are now fungible. So I do think that the impact on our readers has been diminishing attention to, diminishing concern about matters of government at the state level as well as the local level because of what they've seen coming out of Washington. It's not so much that the Times Union is covering Trump world at a greater extent than it did the Obama administration, but it is that people's sensibilities have changed and people's attention to matters of news have been affected by the rawness that has been created by the approach that the Trump administration has taken to issues and facts.
So last question, can you give us your thoughts on how people who think that local and regional news is important can encourage others to follow it?
Well, if I could figure out how to get more people to follow local and regional news, I would be really happy about that, because it would assure the future of the Times Union, which I do think will be, as media diminish, the surviving brand in this marketplace will be the Times Union, as we evolve from ink on crushed trees to being a digital presence on all platforms. You know, the problem is that the loss of local media is significant. There's a new study coming out of the University of Notre Dame, I believe, the business college, that finds that when local media have disappeared, the cost of government has risen because there is less attention to what's going on. So the local media really have an impact on local government. I think that to get more people to pay attention to the news that is covered by the local media, it's really our responsibility in the media to do our jobs better. If we make our report more compelling, if we use all the tools at our disposal to bring the news to where the people are, then we will be more present in their lives. And by the latter, I mean, we can't just say, well, we put out the news in print and toss it on the doorsteps of people who want it and we've done our job. We need to effectively use social media. We need to put news in front of people in forms that they can make use of it. And that even means tailoring the stories to different demographics so that we can make news consumable, credible, useful, so that we can deserve part of the mind share of the audience here in this community.
Well, thanks again for this interview, Rex. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
And for the members of our listening audience, please tune in next week for another interview with Rex about the ways that the contemporary crisis of newspapers has impacted the news climate of the Capital Region.
So that was part one of my interview with Rex Smith. Here's part two, which aired a week later, also in June of 2018.
I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Rex Smith, the editor and vice president of Albany's Times Union newspaper, about the ways that the crisis of print media in the early 21st century has affected the newspaper industry in the Capital Region. Rex, thanks for this interview. It's good to have you as a guest on the Hudson Mohawk Evening Magazine.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be here.
So when people talk about the crisis of newspapers and the crisis of journalism, they're usually referring to a few related topics. One of the topics is the ways in which the advent of digital news sources has impacted newspapers that have traditionally relied on print sales and subscription fees for sizable portions of their budget. Another is the way that this economic challenge has affected the amount of money available to pay journalists and finance the work of long-term investigative news teams. And a third is the emergence of extremely polarized political climates around the country in which agreement about standards of objectivity and general levels of trust in the media are at historic lows. So before we get to the more locally focused questions, I'm wondering if you can give us your more general take on the impact that these changes have had on newspapers and on American society's relationship to print journalism overall.
Well, it's been an epical change. About 15 years ago, in fact, I remember being in a meeting of media leaders, a few of whom at least were journalists, and our speaker was the guy who'd been the head of Imagineering for Disney. Isn't that a great title? The head of Imagineering. And he said, you know, I know some of you in the room, some of you journalists are saying that the rise of digital is akin to the invention of movable type. He said, you know, you're wrong. That changed the world, yes. He said, but the internet is not Gutenberg. The internet is the invention of the wheel. That's how much digital is going to change the world, he said. And it was eye-opening to me to think in that context. It may have been somewhat hyperbole, but it has had a tremendous effect on us because digital makes the barriers to entry, in economic terms, much lower. It used to be that to have the access to people as a storyteller in the news media, you needed to be able to afford to build a press, and so you had to be rich. Or you needed to be a journalist hired by somebody rich, in my case, for example, the Hearst Corporation. But nowadays, anybody who can build a website, which is inexpensive to do, can pose as credible a news source as we are. So we have lost the market protection, basically, that was afforded by the old technology. The great vision of the democratizing value of the web is something to behold, and we should celebrate that. But the result is that the credibility that had been established over years and the practice of storytelling that we had established has been challenged. Newspapers used to derive 3/4 of their revenue from advertising on the print pages and 1/4 from the sales of the newspaper on the newsstand. And now we have existed for now 20 years in an environment where people are accustomed to getting all the information free on the web. We're beginning to charge people now for most of the value-laden journalism that we produce. Folks can still get photo galleries and lighthearted stuff and breaking news on TimesUnion.com for free. But if you want access to our real journalism, even digitally, you'll have to pay for it. But the result of the change in American buying habits also has had a significant impact on us. Brick and mortar stores are going away. Malls are disappearing. And the result is that all of that advertising that used to be in the Times Union in order to reach people is now targeted digitally. And people are buying online instead of going to the stores. All of this has had the impact of reducing the capacity of our newsrooms to have the revenue stream we need to do the news reporting that we value. This newsroom that I'm in has about half the number of journalists as it had when I came here as the managing editor, the number two job in the newsroom in 1995. If you've cut your news team in half, you will produce less valuable content than you used to. We've tried to focus on what's valuable, but it has had a tremendous deleterious effect by and large, even though on the web you have greater storytelling capacity than we ever had in print.
So can you comment on the effect that this has had on the Times Union's ability to engage in long-term news stories, long-form investigations?
Yes. What we've tried to do is focus on the stuff that really matters. For example, here's a sensational example, NXIVM, the, some would say, cult that has been based in Albany. Now, Keith Raniere, the RPI graduate who is the leader of this group, is in a federal prison. We did a huge year-long study of NXIVM that we published in 2012, and to commit your resources to something that big is significant, and it takes a commitment to commit our resources to state government investigative reporting. We have done that. I'm very proud of the fact that a book just published by Fordham University Press by a communications professor named Beth Noble, the book is called The Watchdog Still Barks, How Accountability Reporting Evolved for the Digital Age. And she has reached the conclusion by studying 9 different newspapers across the country, 25 years of content, she has reached the conclusion that it confirms the Times Union's abiding interest in deep watchdog reporting. And what she has said is that a lesson for other newspapers from the Times Union, quote, resources saved by making news gathering more efficient can be redeployed toward the creation of important original reporting. And that is that by focusing your reporting resources more specifically on the kind of watchdog reporting that you consider important, you can still maintain that. But it does mean you're giving up some other stuff. In our case, we know that we're missing some breaking news. We know that we're missing some of the traditional government stories that we used to have. But you have to maintain your commitment to the certain kind of enterprise reporting that only newspapers have provided. Otherwise, you'll just be as superficial as television news reporting, and there will be no value to your readers to come to the Times Union that they might see as being a better alternative to any of the local TV stations.
So I think one of the reasons that you've been praised in this book is the fact that you've made a decision that to some extent is counter to the decision that a lot of other papers have made when they're dealing with that trade-off of breaking news or long-form investigative journalism. You're going for the latter more than the former. And if you compare that to something, for instance, like the Saratogian in Saratoga Springs, which has done exactly the opposite, that's had a real effect on the quality of the news that's being produced there. Just general comment on that?
Yes, and we're very lucky in that regard because of ownership. The Saratogian and The Record and the Kingston Daily Freeman, we now publish all those three newspapers, by the way. They're owned by this hedge fund company, Alden Capital, which is a terrible owner. The difficulty for a lot of American newspapers is that in consolidating all of these then high revenue assets in the 70s and 80s, these companies that bought up newspapers amassed huge debt loads. And to service that debt, they had to diminish their expenses. How could they do that? They could do it by cutting their newsrooms. I happen to work for a privately held company. I'm very lucky. Hearst was smart in the way that they did their investments. And it's not that we haven't had to make cuts. We have. It is just that I work for a company that doesn't take on debt. And the result is that we don't have that heavy burden of having to finance the, we have not financed the expansion of Hearst on the shoulders of the local consumers of news products. So we have that luxury. It is a sad thing to see what has happened to community newspapers like those. In the early 90s, I was the editor of The Record in Troy. And at that time, when I became the editor of The Record in 1991, the audited circulation was 41,000 daily. And as the cuts were being made, we used to, with black humor, refer to it as the drive for 25. We thought 25,000 was like the lowest base of circulation we could be. Today, the circulation of The Record is below 5,000. And that kind of cut has had a demonstrable effect in the community, I think. And it's a shame. And we try to pick it up as much as we can, but we can't do as much in Troy as the entire staff that I used to have in Troy could do. And so we know it's had an effect. You still have to do what you can with enterprise reporting, but you have to hope that your owners recognize that this is not like selling low-quality products at a high price. We do have a social responsibility here, notwithstanding the fact that there's a profit motive on the part of our publisher. That is definitely the case. And my publisher, George Hearst, is quick to say, no margin, no mission. He cares about the profit margin. But you have to respect the responsibility that you have as well in your to your community.
Okay, so last question. I'm wondering if you can say something about the ideal of journalistic objectivity in today's polarized political and cultural climate. Do you think it's an ideal worth preserving? And if so, how might this be done, particularly in the face of the highly ideological news sources that people are increasingly turning to on cable and on the internet?
I think fairness is essential. I use that word rather than objectivity because true objectivity, you know, as humans is impossible. I do think that the highest calling for a journalist is truth-telling. To that end, we have painted on the walls of our main conference room in the newsroom the four major tenets of the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. And the first of those tenets is this: seek the truth and report it as fully as possible. Now, truth-telling does not mean just reporting back what somebody said to you. You know, if you report that Donald Trump said his inaugural crowd was the biggest in history, and if you don't point out that that is not true, you are not being true to the journalistic axiom of truth-telling. That's why we get in trouble with an administration that is not committed to truth-telling. So it is very difficult these days to confront the reality that many people in our audience prefer to believe misstatements because they square with their political ideologies than to believe our very best efforts to be truth tellers. And we are then identified as being partisans when all that we are trying to do is apply the same standards of truth telling to this political climate as we have always applied. That is misinterpreted often as being partisan or biased, but we can't do anything else. I can't shy away from that. We have to be rigid in our adherence to truth-telling, fair to the other side. But if we were to say that climate change is not happening and give that equal weight to the scientists who are pointing out to the reality of climate change, we would be shirking our responsibility. Balance is not the objective in journalism. Truth-telling is, and that's the difference between what I think our responsibility as journalists is and what some of our critics see that they want us to be doing.
Well, thanks very much for this interview, Rex. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks very much, Aaron. Glad to have the opportunity.
That was part one and two of my interview with Rex Smith. For my last segment, here's my recent interview with Kartik Bala about his new video game company, Volan Studios, which is located here in Troy.
I'm Aaron Pednati, and today I'm interviewing Kartik Bala about his new video game company and its relationship to other game development projects in the upstate region. With his brother Guha, Kartik founded Vicarious Visions, a very successful game development company based in Menands, New York. In 2005, Kartik and Guha sold the company to their publisher Activision, and in 2016, they left the company and started Valen Studios, which is based here in Troy. Kartik, thanks for coming on the show today. It's good to be talking with you.
Pleasure to be here.
So to start out, can you give us the basics on Valen Studios? What types of games is it going to make, and in what ways is it different from Vicarious Visions?
So Valen Studios, our mission is really simple. We're building a company to go explore new forms of play Now, that's kind of a very abstract kind of notion, but we're really trying to challenge ourselves creatively to look at what kind of experiences, what kind of interactive experiences can we create that we haven't seen before. You know, technology is rapidly changing. There's all kinds of new technologies that are coming to the forefront in AR, VR, artificial intelligence, new ways of interaction. And we're like, how can we take advantage of some of these technologies in unique ways, create new kind of play patterns? And so some of these could be just in software. Some of these could be unique combinations of hardware and software. But the fundamental notion is, can we go out and create something new that people haven't played before and really have fun doing that? So as opposed to like, hey, you know, we're working on something that's an established intellectual property. Can we go create something new?
So what factors informed your choice of Troy as a base of operations?
You know, there's a really cool scene that's been building over the last few years in downtown Troy. There's a real sort of creative culture. There's other game companies in downtown Troy. It was really important that we have a very walkable kind of city. You know, Menands was great, gave us the space that we needed at Vicarious, but it wasn't very walkable. And we wanted to be able to, like, go out to the coffee shop. And you know, creativity comes, you know, all hours of the day and all hours of the night. And we wanted to have that kind of atmosphere to be part of. And we wanted to be able to contribute back into Troy. So my first office was in Troy. And it's nice kind of coming back and building a new studio there.
So I recently watched a keynote address that you and your brother gave at the 2017 Upstate Unleashed conference. And in it, your brother gave a breakdown of the situation for video game and tech development companies in the upstate area that I found very interesting. In a nutshell, he said that it's relatively easy for upstate startups to find angel investors, meaning initial investors who are willing to put some money into helping a company get started. In fact, he said the upstate angel community is now more robust than it ever has been. But then he went on to say that the situation for startups is not so rosy when it comes to deal flow, meaning opportunities for capital investment, and also not so rosy for Series A capital financing, meaning the big time investment that a company needs to get past its prototype phase. But after saying this, he went on to talk about how your new company is putting together a business syndicate that will attempt to fill that gap, at least to some extent. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about this project and some of the specifics. You probably need to stay on the down low, but can you comment on it in a general sense?
Sure. So when we wanted to go back to our roots as entrepreneurs, we wanted to do two things. We wanted to build a new game studio, a new kind of culture focusing on new types of ideas, but we also wanted to provide support for other local entrepreneurs and other startups in the way that we got support in the early years. And so we set up Valence Studios as a means of building our next great game studio, but we also set up Valence Ventures. And Valence Ventures is focused around supporting other startups and entrepreneurs. And, you know, my brother is right. And in terms of there is a decent amount of angel investment in the region. And that's something that we've all worked very hard over the last 20 years to bring to bear. But the next stage is, okay, the startup is off the ground. There's a prototype or there's some level of sort of proven technology or business at the initial scale. But what happens next? You know, they need support to be able to grow that business and scale. And that's incredibly challenging, especially if you're turning it into a global business. And it requires, you know, lead investors who can work closely with those businesses and then be able to bring in capital from outside of the region to be able to support these companies.
So you're kind of stepping into a gap, doing something that's necessary that no one else is doing in the area.
You know, I think that you do have some of it going on. It's not at a critical mass yet. You know, in Silicon Valley and in other, you know, big cities and other states, this exists. There is a pathway there. You can get the introductions necessary and the capital is there ready to invest. In limited quantities, it's here in this region. And that's what's necessary. It's necessary to grow that, you know, Series A and Series B investments in the region to be able to have these companies grow and grow their headquarters here in this region as well, instead of just being acquired, which is not a bad thing. It's a really good thing, but it'd be nice to build more companies that are homegrown in this region and where the headquarters stays here.
Okay, so my last question is, can you comment on the overall state of the video game industry and development community here in Troy? What's your assessment of the situation on the ground?
You know, I'm pretty bullish, you know, about what's happening here in the region. I think you just have to look at the last few years. You know, you've got Vicarious, that's part of Activision. Agora Games got bought by Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers Games has a presence here and building their studio and continuing to invest. Earlier this year, Mad Glory up in Saratoga was bought by PUBG Corporation. PUBG is one of the biggest games on the planet. It's a Korean company. And so you've got a variety of investments happening, you know, from bigger companies who are investing into the region and having those studios grow. On the other end of the spectrum, you have new startups. You know, RPI had an accelerator program for the summer that was dedicated to all game companies and, you know, new game ideas. So we're going to start seeing more of those, and it's really nice to see that happening. The Capital Region is going to have the first esports conference in March at the Capital Center. Really excited about that because it's going to bring in lots of area and regional colleges and universities to participate in that. It's part of MAC and ECAC who are running that tournament. So we're really excited about all the different activities that are going on in the region. There's still a lot to do. There's a lot to do to kind of create this robust ecosystem where, regardless of your interests and stuff in gaming, whether you want to be independent and freelance, if you want to work on passion projects, or you want to be part of a big studio, or you want to work on experimental or educational type of games, you want to be able to create this robust community that can support all that. And that's what's really going to be built to last. Built to last as a, you know, as a region, as a game cluster here in upstate New York.
Well, thanks again, Kartik, for coming in today. And it was a pleasure talking to you. And we at the Sanctuary of Independent Media wish you the best of luck with your new endeavor.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So that was a retrospective on some of my best interviews from 2018. This is Aaron Pednotti signing off and wishing you all a very happy new year.